And welcome to our show, Dean Brown. Good morning. We're just giving people a little bit of a background where you are and why you were there, and that you reminding folks of your six-month sojourn in the Supermax and sort of the state that brought inmates into and what it made prison guards into itself, and about how they're officials, good and bad, and there you are, smack in the middle of it.
Anyway, they took the... I had my harmonica, and I was talking to my friend, and the commercial, can you hear me now?
Oh, yeah.
And the officer came by, and he swore at me and everything, and took my harmonica and threatened to keep it if I didn't come see him after my visit. I went after my visit, and I said, what did I do wrong? I said, what rule did I violate? He said, you violated my rule. I said, what rule? It's none of your effing business, you know?
And what?
Yeah.
I'll rule you my way.
Yeah, there's no posting of this rule. I said, what did I do that was offensive? Trying to be civil and polite and everything. I wrote a letter, and I sent a copy for the website. I don't know if you've received it yet.
No, sure haven't.
It's a letter to the warden. I'll bang out another copy this weekend, and I'll send it in the mail Monday. But this man's been... I mean, I personally witnessed him beating a young prisoner, and I almost got involved in the melee myself, but the sergeant that I was complaining to, listen, get in there and break that up or I'm going to, came running out and locked the door behind me and insisted that I return to my living area, and I did, and I called Beth, and she got a state senator or somebody out of bed up top, and they got the state police in, and so it's all recorded and everything, and my story matches the victim story, and we had no opportunity to fabricate anything, so they couldn't punish me for it. But this same Sergeant Brownell has been accused publicly, or excuse me, officially with the administration of assaulting several other inmates, and nothing's done about it. And that's kind of scary. But that, you know, same sergeant just pulled this crap again on me, my harmonica.
Now, what was his name again? I'm sorry.
Robert Brownell. He's a sergeant.
Okay.
In fact, he made sergeant right after they got the kid I witnessed being assaulted was Keith Provencia. He was, beaten up a little bit, and his handcuffs and his hands were pulled up behind his back, and it doubled him over, and Brownell was holding the handcuffs with his left hand and driving the fist of his right hand up into the man's chest and ribcage area. And it was infuriating to watch, but the sergeant picked up a clipboard and held it over his face as he ran out the door so he could pretend that he didn't see it. Because legally, he could say he didn't see it.
Monkey see, monkey do. Oh,
yeah.
God.
But that kind of pranks continue around here. And then,
do you think this will go into their incident reports?
Yeah, but how it goes in is a question. Because the investigator refused to see me. They said, if your unit manager decides that you need to see an investigator, then he'll get you one, and he's on vacation for the week.
Oh,
so
okay.
I said, well, I got a friend on the streets that won't have any trouble getting in touch with the state police and having them investigate. So it was in the newspaper the next day. Associate Commissioner Denise Lloyd confirmed that an officer had been accused of assaulting an inmate. So that hit the Bangor Daily News, and I got a copy of that article, and that was on. They didn't mention any names except the inmate's name.
Right, but it's shown light on this problem, and it, these guys can
manipulate. They manipulate the outcome by telling that this kid was, really problematic and hyper and ADD and all of that.
Uh-huh.
And Thomaston, a bunch of us long timers, tried helping him out, get him to come out in the population, stop cutting his arms, go to school, straighten up, and get the hell out of here. Which, is what the system's supposed to be designed to do. But he had a run-in with the staff, and they put him in the hole, and he had all these write-ups, disciplinary reports with sanctions that had been suspended on good behavior. And what happened, that I told him that if he didn't plead guilty to this incident, then they were going to revoke all of the suspended time and just keep him in the supermax till the sentence was over. So the kid pled guilty, and then that let the sergeant off the hook, and they gave him a sergeant's stripes.
Well, isn't that a
clever
little two-step?
Yeah, it's par for the course here. This reporter, Lance Tapley, sent me a copy of the National Institute on Coretta, think tank for the United States Justice Department. They were requested by the commissioner when Lance Tapley's first article about the torture in the Supermax came out. They requested these people to come look at the prison, the Supermax specifically, and see what they were doing wrong. And they did that. They came in and they filed a 9-page technical assistance report.
Really?
Chronicling what was wrong with the way they were running Supermax. And they recommended that the prison send personnel to the state of Colorado to see how a Supermax is properly run. And because Maine is the only state I know of where prisoners can't have a toothbrush because they're dangerous, but you can shave 3 times a week with a real razor blade. And, you know, the most assaulted prisoners are given sharpened pencils in one area, but they can't have felt-tip soft pens because they'll mark up the walls with them, which is what they give the rest of the Supermax people. They give them the pens because the pencils are too dangerous. But the inmates who stab the guards or, you know, other inmates or whatever get thrown down in the lower L, they're given sharpened pencils. It makes no sense. But it comes down to one man making a rule, and everybody sticks by it because nobody overrules anybody. The commissioner, no matter how committed he says he is to change, may be making some subtle changes here and there, I'm not sure, but You would think that the toothbrush issue would have been resolved by now. How many prisons in this country actually follow that same practice? How many prisons in this country have cell extractions almost every day? I mean, why are these people...
Maine is really leading the way in being backward, then.
It was beyond backwards. It just seems like they're running in the opposite direction. It's as counterproductive as you can get. I mean, they want to fill that Supermax with many people and drive if they need a new prison.
Now, you say they, and that's the problem. There's a whole prison industrial establishment, I have to assume.
Exactly. It's from the commissioner on down, not to mention the contractors and you know, the builders.
Right. Food supply.
Pardon me?
Food supply and all those other...
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. This place was built to handle a lot more. The support structure of the facility was designed to accommodate more prisoners than what... housing allowed for. The close custody unit has 436, I believe, cells, but there's one bed in each one. The same size cell in medium custody has two bed bunks in it, and they cut the size of the prison down by 400 and something beds. They simply didn't put them in. The holes are in the walls for those beds to go in.
Okay, so it could easily... Sort of, you could force feed that many more people into the place. There.
Yeah, there's room for them, but the problem is that when they originally built the place, they planned for those beds. The cells are prefabricated, made for those beds to be set in place, bolted into the wall. They just didn't put the beds in, and they took like $10 million or $12 million off the cost of the new prison to appease the legislature, and then went over budget by that same amount. But the only difference between what they wanted for a facility and what they got for a facility is how many beds. They said they wanted to build a 1,200 and something bed facility, and they ended up with an 800 and something bed facility. But it's the exact same facility minus the physical beds themselves being put in the cells.
Well, let me ask you then. Let's say that they're simply the fascists looking down the road and thinking, well, we're going to be bringing in political prisoners and all that pretty soon for people that object to our authoritarian government. And what would happen, say, if there were suddenly an onload of say, political dissent type people there that were only charged with, with writing the wrong things about Bush or whatever it was?
Well, you know, the funny thing about that is if they had to let anybody go, if they wanted to scare the hell out of the public because they can't get funding for something, they'll say, oh, we're going to let the rapists and the murderers go free. That's what you're asking us to do, which would leave the pot smokers and the drunk drivers in here, and the thieves. But they used that ploy to scare the hell out of the public to get funding. It worked in Thomaston when they got it in Thomaston.
Yeah.
I watched these people shortly before this place opened up, I swear to God. They took a bunch of prisoners from Wyndham with like anywhere between 30 days and 90 days remaining on their sentence. They brought them to Thomaston by the busload, threw them in the dormitory, and that same day, the Channel 5 or Channel 13, I believe it was Channel 5 TV, came in to do an article on how overcrowded the prison was. And here's these 30 or 40 prisoners in that room.
Potemkin overcrowding, they'd call it.
A week later, they went to Bucks Harbor, the facility up the Downey's Correctional Center in Bucks Harbor, Maine.
Yeah.
They went up there, and some of the same people that were in the first news article in Thomaston were on the second one, because those people were transferred up there ahead of that article, showing that it wasn't just in Thomaston that was overcrowded. The whole system was overcrowded.
Well, this is just crazy, though. I mean, it's
lying to the public. They do it with no thought. I mean, they're not teaching people in here how to function in society. We had problems with how we functioned or related to society.
Yeah.
We're not learning. I mean, yeah, we know right from wrong. I'm not excusing that. But as far as functioning in society, as a productive member of society, most of us in here have no clue. We couldn't or wouldn't, for whatever reason, do it. We're not getting any guidance on that. When we try to get guidance, we try to establish programming in here to help people become better parents. They put roadblocks in front of that. They put a restriction on the phone that, you know, yeah, they're going to pay the phone company 7 or 8 cents a minute for the call, but they're going to charge you, the Department of Corrections is going to charge you, the receiver of the call, like a dollar something for the first minute, and then like cents or 35 cents for each additional minute.
Right. It's inmates as profit centers.
Well, yeah, and it's just there's so little to be had there, and statistics have shown that the children of offenders are the most likely to become offenders in society. And it would seem to me that anybody with a conscience could sit down and come up with a plausible way to bridge the gaps between prisoners and their children.
We're talking with Dean Brown. He's our correspondent at Maine State Prison, prisoner number 4059. And let me ask you about cultural items. Are there a library there? You know, is it well stocked? Does it respond to people's requests? You know, are there videos or anything else that's supposed to help keep everyone in touch with, you know, the cultural scene in America?
We have a library, pretty much stocked by request. Not that that large a library for the amount of prisoners here. The librarian, Jackie Weddle, bless her soul, she did the best she can with what little bit she has available to her. She's always pleasant and everything, you know, like the school mom type of librarian. And, you know, she does her best to request things that she doesn't have in the library or that money won't allow her to get. She'll request things like the Bangor Public Library. They get an interlibrary loan program, and they allow them to borrow books that way. They'll request it from, say, Bangor, and Bangor, if they don't have it, will request it and then loan it to us. Yeah. And, of course, if anything happens to it, the prisoner has to pay for the cost of replacing the book.
What about music, then? It sounds like, I mean, I have to assume, is that something that people simply order on their own?
Yeah, we have to order that through the canteen, who, of course, marks it up there 20%.
Right, making their money off the inmates.
Right,
the inmates.
And your order will have to wait until the prison makes a large enough order that they're going to get a kickback from the company. If you spend X amount of dollars, we'll knock so much off the bill type of bill.
Huh.
So they're spending the money to get what we're requesting. And when they have the CDs, they get a discount from the company that we should be getting. And then they pocket that, and they add 20% markup to it, and then they pocket that as well.
Hmm.
And then they use the money to, you know, go out and lobby, and they give it to, like, the University of Maine School of Law, not to help prisoners in filing lawsuits against the prison or appealing prison decisions. Disciplinary decisions. These people can't help us with it.
Just with getting divorced or writing a will or something?
Exactly. Oh. Or appealing a state agency decision. If your rights are violated, then policy and procedure at the prison is violated in how they reach a classification or disciplinary decision, and you appeal all the way to the top level, your next avenue for relief is to appeal directly to the superior court in the community, say, look, And they decide on the record. Here's the record of what happened, and here's the policy and procedure. And if the record was violated, they solve it right there. The problem that we're having is the Attorney General or the Assistant Attorney General, Diane Sleek, is not only not advising the prison to stop violating their own policies, they're assisting the problem by fighting against the prisoner for the state, representing the state, and the prisoners are losing because they're not lawyers and they're not crossing their T's or dotting their I's, even though the record shows that they're in the right. If a lawyer was aligned and the deadlines are all met and all this legal mumbo-jumbo is taken care of, the Department of Corrections would lose on most of these cases.
So this would require a change in either state law or state regulation, then?
Yeah, oh, definitely.
One of those two.
Somebody somewhere along the line is going to have to say, listen, you can't interfere in this man's rights. I mean, you get a state agency assisting another state agency in violating the rights of prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
And the Attorney General's office knows from looking at these cases and preparing for court that if that prisoner had an attorney or anybody would currently assist him, he's going to win.
Mm.
And when I was in the MAX, I wrote about how three of my friends were shipped out of state. Kurt DeFilippo was one of them. He had a case going, and he had help, and it was getting done correctly. They shipped him out of state and then went to court and said his case is moot because he's no longer in the Supermax. He's in Rhode Island. But they also went on to say that he was sent to Rhode Island for his behavior, which was the same he supposedly did to get in the Supermax in the first place. But there's no disciplinary report of any report of behaving. There was no disciplinary report. There was no disciplinary hearing. Opportunity to defend himself, and the state says, well, they had information from a confidential informant. Well, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that you have to credibly assess the credibility of the informant's information. Otherwise, every prisoner in here has power over the rest of the prisoners. All any inmate has to do in here is say, hey, I heard that inmate say he was going to stab a guard. Boom, that inmate's gone for a year or so. Just like that, no questions asked, no need for a hearing, no defense, and you can't defend against it.
Well, it sounds like, as you said there, the having an advocate that can work with inmates on that kind of thing, on those things would end up straightening out prison policy pretty quick.
We have an advocate in Augusta. His name is Wes Andriniak, and his assistant that represents the prison is Ann Rourke. Ann came to my cell when I was out there. I gave her all my paperwork, and I showed her, and I'm working on getting some photocopies. Money's tight, so I can't really get any photocopier, but I guess somebody's going to help me out. And I'm going to send you copies for the site of the reports written by two captains and a sergeant saying that they searched an area in the prison, and they found radios with speakers in them. And upon investigating, they discovered that I was the one who was putting speakers in the radios and that I had the tools to do it. So they searched my cell looking for those tools, and they found them. I was placed on administrative segregation, put in Supermax for three weeks, released. The disciplinary report against me was subsequently dropped because of procedural error, but was dropped nonetheless. 6 weeks after that incident, one of those captains, David Cutler, and Jim O'Farrell, the deputy warden in charge of security, filled out an administrative segregation placement form, which you have to fill the form out to put them out to put that SEG and throw them in the hole in the Supermax. You got to have paperwork to back it up. And you have to give a description of what the prisoner did and how that prisoner threatened the security or orderly management of the institution. He said that my cell was searched on that day and contraband was found implicating me as an escape risk. That's why they had to put me in a Supermax, and the next day they put me on high risk. Mm-hmm. Well, they put five of us on high risk that same day, and three of them got transferred until the news article came out, and that put the kibosh on the other.
On their whole transfer thing, huh?
Right. And the egg paper had photographs of the contraband they took 6 weeks before. Clearly showing
that these folks are not playing with the, they're cheating.
Yeah.
This whole thing. Let's put it that way.
They made a determination that I was escape risk at 3 o'clock noon. Exactly 3:08 in the afternoon, 3:10 in the afternoon. The same time they received confidential information on four other prisoners that they were involved in whatever activities they were. They wouldn't tell anybody what those activities were. But they got this information at 10 past 3 in the afternoon, plus my cell was searched at 10 past 3 in the afternoon, and they made a determination on all five calls that we needed to be placed on that flag. This was signed, sealed, and delivered at 3:10 p.m. on the 24th of May.
Huh.
That night, at 11:30, they brought us over to the Supermax with dogs and the SWAT team and all that.
Right.
All that.
Oh,
it looked
yes,
like
yes.
There was some big shakeup.
Those radio repair people, you never know.
Yeah, I know. The cable guy was there. But the problem is, they made a determination that I was a threat to security because I was going to escape, and they made this determination at 10 past 3 in the afternoon, I would not have gone, not have found, which requires leaving my unit and going all the way to the prison on the foot to the chow hall. They would not have allowed me out for night rec at 6:30 that night to go out and be on the ball field outside the units.
Yeah. All right.
With access to the fence.
We're gonna start running out of time here at a quick flash. Mm. So, would you say that having this legal advocate, the advocate of the public, Wes...
Andriniak. Yeah, and they didn't work in here. Well, they saw the paperwork and they agreed 100% that I was getting shafted, and they went to the warden and the deputy warden. The warden was out ill, but the deputy warden still just... wrote off on it.
There needs to be a pattern of getting that information to them, building up the public record.
Mm.
All right. Well, any last thoughts here? Because we're going to have to roll
yeah,
on
I just,
the way here.
Want to say thank you to WRFR and the Rockland area a little bit. They care or help or just keep us in your prayers and. Thank you all, and God bless you.
All righty. We've been talking with Dean Brown at Maine State Prison. Dean, thanks a lot, and we hope to be in touch with you in the fairly recent future. We've got a recording of you as well here.
Oh, yes, a letter. I received a letter from the deputy, from Ward Merrill, which is interesting. I received that technical report from Washington through the media, and the rule that is, any publications have to come from a publisher. Well, it did come from a publisher. The publisher's of Fallen Peaks, but the deputy Warden Merrill said that it was photocopied, so I could buy the photocopies from his office at 25 cents a page.
There they go again.
Yeah, and it's just, it's an open joke. I got people in here copying the letter, sending copies to their lawyers, and people laugh and they just can't believe it. It's like an ongoing joke here. Yeah. We're not learning respect for and obedience to the laws and the norms of society. We're learning hatred and contempt.
Well, I hope you have an opportunity to get info out. Great day here.
You too, boss. Bye-bye. Yeah.